will not be able to be with us. He had emergency surgery on his eyes on Friday, and according to the doctor's orders, he is not to fly or to venture out for a number of weeks. He's hoping that this will solve his problem, but he was not even able to see his manuscript, so he will not be with us. He sends his warmest regards to you and his regrets that he can't be with you. He was very much looking forward to being here. He wants to take a rain check, and he said he's happy to come back when he's better and do handsprings to show his enthusiasm for coming to Concordia. He gently suggested that perhaps I might have something to say to the assembly. I asked him to send me an essay, but he, as you know, is going to talk on liturgical theology, and he has a book on it. And he lectures now from notes, so he didn't have anything to send. So I am going to present something that I put together the last couple of days. It was first a topic first suggested to me by President Patelko a number of years ago when he asked me to speak to his district on the relationship of style and substance, in which he asked me to look at this from a more secular perspective, how perhaps the arts and the like look at this relationship. And so what I would like to offer in place of Kavanaugh is an essay on the contextualization of worship, subtitled Liturgy and Culture in Conflict or Concord. More and more, American culture is becoming less and less Christian in its values and traditions. The signs are everywhere. A post-Christian culture is emerging that ceases to order its life by the Judeo-Christian ethic. Some may want to debate this issue, but that is for another time and place. As the Church of Jesus Christ, we pray for the world. But how tragic that Christian ethics no longer affect the decisions of our society as they once did. By and large, the Church's role in society is ridiculed or ignored. Its voice is silent as the secular society sets the agenda. The Church has its own set of problems, however, and those problems inhibit it from addressing a culture that is becoming increasingly hostile to Christian values and mores. The Church must also bear responsibility for contributing to the current cultural crisis. Are we clearly articulating the Christian vision to our people? And are they, in turn, making decisions on the basis of that vision? By turning on a television or reading a newspaper or magazine or listening to the radio or attending a town meeting, we are inundated with the culture's conversation about every conceivable issue. Public radio and television have their agendas. Fundamentalist stations broadcast their views. Rock music asserts its values. Country music describes its lifestyle. And the blues tell it like it is. But in every case, a culture's values is shaped by the public discourse of that culture, whether it be in the form of political debate, music videos, or talk radio. How is it possible, then, to talk about the contextualization of the liturgy, about the relationship between culture and liturgy, without discussing culture? Every time a pastor writes a sermon, picks a hymn, or prepares a liturgy, culture is hanging about, peering over his shoulder. Culture is everywhere. It is certainly an understatement to exclaim that the relationship between liturgy and culture is a burning issue in our church today. It is said that a new age has dawned, so to speak, and a new worship is called for. Questions of relevance and cultural suitability abound, indicating that it is time to discuss as openly and objectively as possible the dynamic tension between culture and liturgy. This brings to our discussion two distinct but related subjects. The first issue is contextualization, namely, the effect of the environment on worship, or to put it more plainly, the effect of culture on liturgy. The second issue derives from the contextualization question namely, how the clash of liturgy and culture affects liturgical style. Our concern is the relationship between the Lutheran expression of the biblical content of our liturgies, the effect of culture upon that content, and the liturgical style we choose as the means for communicating that substance. I would like you to know that I am going to be operating from T.S. Eliot's definition of culture in his Notes Towards the Definition of Culture. And the reason I use it is because it was used by Niebuhr in Christ and Culture, and more specifically for my purposes, by Jeffrey Wainwright in his Doxology, The Praise of God in Worship, Doctrine, and Life. And Eliot defines culture as, quote, the total pattern of the particular society with all its assumptions, values, and forms, a whole way of life, unquote. And what Wainwright does is he wants to emphasize, quote, the intellectual and artistic modes and achievements of our society, the philosophical, technical, and aesthetic products that result from Western culture and in part constitute it. This is significant for us because in Wainwright's discussion of culture, he emphasizes that liturgy is the meeting place between faith and culture. And I think you're going to see as we go along that I am going to make a distinction between the secular or popular culture and the religious culture. The style and substance question must become part of our conversation as well. Is style culturally neutral, or does style influence the substance? This question will be a critical part of my discussion about contextualization, and I shall investigate it by looking at style and substance in the arts, particularly the popular culture of film and literature. But first, I think we must address the question of contextualization that is most obvious to us, and that is that Lutheran worship occurs in a Lutheran context. And so the first part is Lutheran contextualization. Many people today are driving an artificial wedge between those who want to maintain a traditional form of Lutheran liturgy and those who want liturgy to speak to this day and age. Let me begin by saying that I do not believe that these are mutually exclusive. There are some who desire a nostalgic 16th century liturgy and could care less about whether it speaks to today's world. And there are some who want to discard everything Lutheran in favor of an American Protestant liturgy. But the majority of us want Lutheran liturgy in a modern context. The issue is not traditional liturgy on one hand and contemporary liturgy on the other. Rather, the question before us is how Lutheran liturgy is both ancient and contemporary, and how best to proclaim that to this generation. The subtitle of this essay is a question: Liturgy and Culture in Conflict or Concord? And perhaps as a good Lutheran, my answer to that is yes. Sometimes in conflict and sometimes in concord. The tension facing every pastor is when conflict and when concord. In recent times, too much of our liturgy has been given away to a culture that is hostile and antithetical to Lutheran theology. And the reason is not what many people think it is or say it is. There is no great malevolence here, no crazed society for the death of the liturgy. These are sincere pastors and lay people who want to save souls by appealing to people in a way that won't turn them off. The problem is that most of us are ill-equipped to make the theological and liturgical decisions necessary to determine when conflict and when concord. We may be equipped to do this theologically. That is, we can tell, perhaps, a Pentecostal hymn from a Lutheran one. But are we capable of analyzing liturgical structures and diagnosing liturgical diseases? Are most pastors trained in music so they can decide a good liturgical tune from a bad one? In speaking about the contextualization of liturgy, it would be misleading to address only the pop culture, to jump to the secular context and forget the theological one. The most important context of Lutheran worship that shapes our distinct Lutheran ethos is scripture, theology, and history. Local circumstance is always secondary. Traditionally, this Lutheran context is liturgical, theological, and countercultural. Lutheran contextualization is theological. To ignore theology would shift the discussion exclusively to that of style, and therefore falsely separate style from substance. And I will go into this later. Lutheran contextualization requires knowing the tradition so that if I decide to depart from it, I do so from knowledge and not from ignorance. Liturgical ministers need to know the historical context of their tradition, particularly the context of biblical history. What impact does the worship of the Old and New Testaments, of Israel and the Church, have on our Lutheran context today? The eschatological context of worship accents the continuity of liturgy from generation to generation. The ancient Eucharistic prayers, for example, with their long recital of God's great acts of salvation in biblical and ecclesiastical history, proclaim the presence of the whole church at the liturgy, past, present, and future. The great witnesses of the faith are present in the assembly because Christ is present in the assembly. Therefore, we do not worship alone in this time and this place and this language. We worship with every generation of the church in one unified liturgy where Jesus Christ and heaven itself are present in the word and the sacrament. For liturgy to become associated with a particular place and a particular time would seriously hinder the church's expression of the eschatological character of its worship. In every age, liturgy bespeaks a transcultural and transtemporal message. The faithful worship with a liturgy they did not invent, but which they have made their own, the liturgy of their fathers, their grandmothers, their great-grandfathers, and so on. It is not insignificant, for example, that Jesus sang Isaiah 6 and Psalm 118, which is our Sanctus, in the synagogue of Nazareth, or that he sang Psalm 118 on his way to Gethsemane on the night in which he was betrayed. For the people of God to join Jesus and all of heaven in that ancient hymn before it receives him in with and under bread and wine forms them into his body, the church. If our liturgies are too contemporary and omit the historical witness, they risk becoming sectarian, isolationist, and incapable of communicating the gospel that knows no cultural boundaries. The liturgy bound to one locale and one people ceases to proclaim Christ for all people in all times and in all places and becomes, therefore, by definition, sectarian. The Lutheran context of liturgy imposes a grave theological responsibility upon liturgists as they lead the people of God in worship. The first allegiance in mediating between liturgy and culture is faithfulness to the biblical witness and the Lutheran theological tradition that preserves that witness in the liturgy. Any liturgical adaptation must take into account the tradition and the structure of the liturgy. The various theological influences that exert pressure upon us in our peculiar cultural context, particularly the theological impact of evangelicalism, can no longer be ignored. Pastors, musicians, and lay people need to immerse themselves in a Lutheran liturgical heritage. Ignorance of that context will result in liturgical adaptations that will affect the theological substance of the liturgy. A tremendous amount of literature exists to assist our understanding of the biblical context of liturgy and its influence upon history, time, structure, theology, missions, eschatology. That is about the only theology I'm going to do. I'm now going to go to cultural contextualization, and I'm going to talk about style and substance in the arts. Along with the contextualization of liturgy comes the question of style, especially in view of the current propensity to separate style from substance. This bifurcation between form and content would appear curious to those who regularly engage in artistic endeavors that deal with questions of substance and style. As an example of this, I am going to refer to a standard text used in high school and college freshman English classes, Strunk and White's Timeless, The Elements of Style. E.B. White, who is the one who edited William Strunk, his English professor's material, he has some observations here about writing that bore such close resemblance to both liturgy and preaching that it prompted Aidan Cavanaugh, who is going to be with us, to take White's stylistic principles and apply them to the liturgy in a book that he entitled The Elements of Rite. And O.C. Edwards to do the same for preaching in his Elements of Homiletic. Both are reliable textbooks in teaching liturgy and homiletics, as my seminary students will testify. And both Cavanaugh and Edwards are based on the essential outline of E.B. White's Elements of Style. Now, without Strunk and White's Elements of Style, most students, however, would not know where to begin. And I begin with that in my class on homiletics. And I'd like to cite White here, some of his concepts and his comments on language and literary style to help orient us in a discussion of style and substance in the arts. And I'm just going to read a chunk from his An Approach to Style, his fifth part, the last part of his book. This is E.B. White. Up to this point, the book has been concerned with what is correct or acceptable in the use of English. In this final chapter, we approach style in its broader meaning, style in the sense of what is distinguished and distinguishing. Here we leave solid ground. Who can confidently say what ignites a certain combination of words, causing them to explode in the mind? Who knows why certain notes in music are capable of stirring the listener deeply through the same note, though the same notes slightly rearranged are impotent? These are high mysteries, and this chapter is a mystery story thinly disguised. There is no satisfactory explanation of style, no infallible guide to good writing, no assurance that a person who thinks clearly will be able to write clearly. No key that unlocks the door, no inflexible rule by which the young writer may shape his course. He will often find himself steering by stars that are disturbingly in motion. Style is an increment in writing. When we speak of F. Scott Fitzgerald's style, we don't mean his command of the relative pronoun. We mean the sound his words make on paper. Every writer, by the way he uses the language, reveals something of his spirit, his habits, his capacities, his bias. This is inevitable as well as enjoyable. All writing is communication. Creative writing is communication through revelation. It is the self escaping into the open. No writer long remains incognito. Style takes its final shape more from attitudes of mind than from principles of composition. For, as an elderly practitioner once remarked, writing is an act of faith, not a trick of grammar. This moral observation would have no place in a book where it is not that, this moral observation would have no place in a rule book were it not that style is the writer. And therefore, what a man is, rather than what he knows, will at last determine his style. If one is to write, one must believe in the truth and worth of the scrawl, in the ability of the reader to receive and decode the message. No one can write decently who is distrustful of the reader's intelligence or whose attitude is patronizing. The end of E.B. White. I think you can see in E.B. White that substance and style are not to be separated unless one's going to see that they are going to adversely affect one another. For as he says, style reveals substance. Style is an act of faith that reveals who we are. To write a book, produce a film, paint a picture, or compose a symphony reveals who we are and what we believe. Style reveals substance by increment, says White. Substance cannot be actualized as reality without style. So that expanding on White's comments, I'd like to quote a little Kavanaugh here, and I promised him I would, so that you don't feel like you've been deprived. And I'm citing him from Elements of Right, in which he's talking now about liturgical style. And I won't read too much, but I'll just read what really has a basis on what White is saying. This is what Kavanaugh says. Liturgy, style, education, and social formation are increments to larger and more radical realities. But these larger and more radical realities, that is, meaning and being human, become operational and intensified only in their incremental dimensions. An organism, for example, may be essentially human without educational or social increments, but such an organism rarely becomes operationally humane except by such incremental processes as education and social interaction with others of the same species. The potentialities inherent in the human organism are there to be actualized. The same may be said of meaning and its actualizing increment, style. Now here Kavanaugh is going to quote E.B. White. He says, "All writing communicates meaning, but writing that has style communicates meaning through revelation." In E.B. White's felicitous phrase, it is the self escaping into the open. Every act of style represents the writer seducing others into the meaning revealed, not by enslavement, but by liberation. Nor is style a mere garnish to prose, something separate from meaning. It is a quality one discovers as one really works at perceiving the meaning all things possess. The approach to it, White counsels, is by way of plainness, simplicity, orderliness, and sincerity. And my students in homiletics know how much I accent those from E.B. White. Now, one final paragraph now when he talks about liturgy in terms of style. One steps away from a superb act of liturgy in which one has communed palpably not only with one's own self or one's immediate neighbor, but with the divine persons immersed in the life of the world, changed in one's whole address to existence itself. When one remembers, for example, all the unknown people over the past 5,000 years who have loved this same vast mystery and transmitted it to one in this place and this time, one is moved by the splendid pity of it all. And one is freed to associate the unassociable, the deathless, uncreated, and timeless creator of all, with the simple human creatures of bread broken and wine poured out to rejoice mortal hearts. So far, Kavanaugh. Now, I believe that White's claims for language and Kavanaugh's for liturgy need to be tested. By looking at style and substance in the arts, particularly in film and literature, we shall see how secular culture understands the relationship between these two. And at the end of the day, we must ask if this relationship also applies to the liturgies we write and the liturgies we do on Sunday morning. The first example from popular culture concerns film. And the reason I chose it is most of us see a movie now and then. In the late fall of 1991, there was an article in the Boston Globe, the Sunday's arts section, entitled Elements of Style. It was written by John Koch. Some of you may know him. Since this review comes from a newspaper that hundreds of thousands of readers in the greater Boston area read on a cold December afternoon, I thought it would be appropriate as a vehicle for discussing style and substance in the arts. Koch begins this way. How many times have you seen a movie's look or style briskly kissed off in a phrase or two toward the end of a review? Surely too many to count. Whether reviews acknowledge it or not, genuine style is more than skin deep, the look of a movie more than a question of grooming. It can't be affixed to a film like a decal or applied like wax to make the action shine on screen. Not anyway if the movie is going to amount to more than hackwork. What reviewers are inclined to mention curtly as a movie's look is really a matter of the visual language which a film expresses itself. And if it's awkward or underdeveloped, the movie will suffer and possibly fail, no matter how dramatic the screenplay is or how artfully it puts words in people's mouths. We tend to discuss movies more in terms of the stories they tell than in terms of how they tell them. But in most good movies, the visual textures convey as much, and more often, than the course of the action and the content of the dialogue," end quote. Now, what Mr. Koch goes on to do is review five recent films as to the interplay between this film's screenplay, its content, and the visual effect of the film, what he calls its style. He commends one writer-director's screenplay for its ambitious thematic content, but he laments that he does not have the cinematographic, I've never said that word before, cinematographic style to carry the dramatic focus of his words to a meaningful expression in the film itself. The screenplay has tremendous potential to produce a powerful film, but the style of the film does not realize that potential. Style can prevent the content from coming to full potential. Koch's critique affirms that in film, style has a profound effect on the story told or the message sent. In his review of the other movies, however, Koch demonstrates how a film's visual flavor is virtually its essence. That's his word. He admits that style is not enough to carry a film to complete artistic satisfaction. For he gives his examples of one film that has a gritty style. It captures the substance of the filmmaker's intent. But another film that has dark, ominous tones does not bring the movie to the brink of the screenplay's goal and cannot save the film from its inherent lack of focus. He says that the most artistically successful films are those that wed style and substance together in dramatic unity, focusing the viewer's attention on the emotive power of style. Now, most Americans, when they flip through the cable stations, they know when a public station appears or when a network station appears. And this isn't a question of snobbishness or taste. It really is a question of style. The look, for example, of Masterpiece Theater or Mystery on PBS is distinctly different from a made-for-TV movie or LA Law. A very good example of where style and substance blend together in one satisfying whole is the production direction team of Merchant Ivory, who produced and directed Howard's End, among other films. Some of you may have also seen the movie Room with a View, or The Remains of the Day, which they did, and two related movies that they didn't do, but is similar in the same kind of relationship between substance and style, is The Age of Innocence. Now, I've seen all those. One I haven't seen, because it hasn't come to Fort Wayne, is Shadowlands, about C.S. Lewis. They had a sneak preview last weekend, but this is Fort Wayne, remember. I have heard from people in St. Louis and Milwaukee that they have seen the film and loved it. I have read a review, however, and it says that in Shadowlands, it's captured English academia. So I'm looking forward to seeing it. But anyway, to go back to Howard's End, I want to talk about Howard's End, which is by E.M. Forster. What Merchant and Ivory do is they take the literary substance and style of E.M. Forster's novel and they translate it into film. And almost all the reviews I read admit that the style and substance of Forster's novels are captured by the Merchant Ivory film as they interpret precisely what Forster's novels are trying to tell in Forster's style. Now, watching the movie is supposed to give us the same sensation as reading the book. Style and substance go together perfectly. And interestingly, in the Time Magazine review of this, it begins by saying, and I'm quote Time Magazine here, "The radiant Howard's End caps 30 years of Merchant Ivory filmmaking on the cheap, but with style." And then they make this very poignant comment about substance and style. And I quote again Time Magazine, "Merchant Ivory films have often been admired and reviled for their dogged gentility, the masterpiece theatricality of their style. Even the soggy films proceed at a confidently leisurely pace, as if Ivory realized that these days time is the dearest commodity. Only he can afford it. Happily, the breadth of Howard's End allows Ivory to indulge his visual whims. The riot of landscape, the open-air intimacy of a punt on a stream, while forcing him and the screenwriter to hone every scene ruthlessly, to find economy in gesture, You get the sense of an entire novel, its characters and character, unfolding in 140 minutes. But why all this talk about movies and style? Well, film and television are the most popular media in our culture, and whether we like it or not, they influence people's perception of the liturgy. That is, we who do liturgy are measured by the standards people come to expect from their popular viewing. Today's culture is visually conditioned. Film and television begin with a script, screenplay, or text. They move towards the embodiment of that text in a visual act, whether recorded or live. And every script has stage directions, lighting instructions, sound suggestions, etc. And to bring a text to life, one needs to pay attention to the script's directions if one wants to be faithful to the intent of the text. These directions help create style. Built into the script, which is the substance of the movie, are signals on how the script might take shape in action. But as most of us know, a director has the freedom to interpret the script and the stage directions. Same text, same stage directions, but a completely different interpretation. Much of what we call style is in the interpretation, or what we might call the hermeneutic, although style reflects everything that goes into making a film a film. Again, I go back to John Koch because he describes it this way. Perhaps it's not surprising that we often don't talk about a movie's style. It's complex, for one thing. Just consider what goes into the composition of even a single shot, then add the interplay of light and darkness throughout the film and factor in the tensions and rhythms created in the process of editing. Perhaps we instinctively know how basic all such elements are to the experience of a movie. Yet in our heated conversations about new favorite films, as in the discourse of most daily reviewing, the question of how they are used tends to be scanted, unquote. The look of a film will either first attract us or repel us, and it may even bore us. If it holds our attention, it draws us into its message to reveal its meaning. The style of a film cannot be separated from the film. The relationship of style to substance in film is complex, but it is significant to the overall impact of the film upon the viewer. The same holds true for liturgy. Its look will draw our attention, hold it, and encourage us to listen carefully to the proclamation of God's revelation. Liturgy has its liturgical text and its rubrics, but that is not liturgy. Liturgy is the text enfleshed on Sunday as it is done by God, his pastors, and his people. Although liturgy is not divine drama, it contains elements of drama as everyone contributes to the process of bringing a text to life. Liturgical action is the text in motion, to rephrase Aidan Cavanaugh's definition of liturgy as the people's faith in motion. Liturgical style will note the text, the rubrics, the worship space, the arrangement of the ecclesiastical furniture, the assembly seating, the pastor, other assisting ministers, and any other aspect of the context that might affect the liturgy's action. Like the making of the film, the liturgy's final act on Sunday morning is complex. For better or for worse, the style of the liturgy, the way it is done, will affect the proclamation of the gospel. I now turn to literature. Style in film is different from style in literature. Film is much more complex and explicit than literature, that is obvious. Film's context is visual, literature's is not. Film must consider a larger environment, location, lighting, sound, staging, props, whereas literature has only the printed word and the format of the page. Literary style is dependent on the selection of words, the juxtaposition of words, the structure of sentences, paragraphs, chapters. Many authors become identifiable by their styles. Ernest Hemingway is known for short, curt sentences that portray tough, flawed, tragic men of a lost generation, like Jake Barnes in The Sun Also Rises. Style and substance are inseparable in the most memorable works of modern fiction. From the first chapter of William Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury, the reader knows that he is in the presence of an altered state of reality. Kurt Vonnegut's chaotic style in Slaughterhouse-Five captures the senseless confusion of war. Henry James reflects turn-of-the-century England and America in such masterpieces as The Ambassadors or The Portrait of a Lady. James does this through literary style, through his exquisite grammatical structures and his studied choice of words. Modern authors are noted for experimenting with avant-garde styles that tend to exalt style over substance and sometimes obscure meaning. During this century, much has been made of literary style, since each new decade produces a new style of writing. One need only flip through the latest New York Times book review to catch some treatise on the new literary style. In casting about for some recent literary criticism, one could do no better than John Updike's recent anthology entitled Odd Jobs, Essays and Criticism. Shot through with stylistic observations about the most significant authors during the past two centuries, Updike's most poignant remarks about literary style are reserved for his own writing. In his discussion of the creative imagination, he begins with Herman Melville, but ends with one of his own earliest short stories for The New Yorker called The Happiest I've Been. And concerning the process of writing this story, this is what Updike observes about himself. He says, "The artist who works in words and anecdotes, images and facts, wants to share with us nothing less than his digested life as he conceives it. In the memories and fantasies most precious, however obscurely to him. For the creative imagination, as I conceive it, is wholly parasitic upon the real world, what used to be called creation. Creative excitement and a sense of useful work has invariably and only come to me when I felt I was transferring with a lively accuracy some piece of experienced reality to the printed page. The wish to do justice to the real world compels language into those semi-transparent layers that make a style. No style of form exists in the abstract. Whatever may be true in painting or music, there is no such thing as abstract writing. Words, even when shattered into nonsense, struggle to communicate meanings to us. And behind the most extreme modernist experiments with the language of fiction, Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, the late writing of Gertrude Stein, the automatic writing of Dada, some perception about the nature of reality seeks embodiment," end quote. Reality seeking embodiment is Updike's way of speaking of the manner in which reality's substance takes life through the shape of an author's narrative style. And as Updike would say, an author's prose shares with us his digested life as he conceives it. He does it through words that express meaning and by increment through a style that gives that meaning life. Liturgy is the digested life of the church, its biblical substance, the presence of Christ, life itself, and its peculiar, in our case, Lutheran hermeneutic. And this is given expression by increment through a liturgical style that embodies a church's life as it has been lived out by generations of Lutherans. To paraphrase F. Scott Fitzgerald's last line from The Great Gatsby, liturgy is the church beating on against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past and thrust forward into the future. I now turn to cultic contextualization, style, and substance in liturgy. Nathan Mitchell, who now pens the Amen Corner in Worship, chose the topic liturgy and culture for his first column as commentator on liturgy and things related. He notes a polarization between what he calls the culture critical camp that acclaims that culture should be adapted, that culture should be adapted to liturgy, and the culture friendly camp that insists that the church should adapt liturgy to culture. And I now want to talk about those two camps. And I begin with the culture-friendly camp. Our analysis of style and substance in liturgy must begin with this camp. Much of the discussion about liturgy among the culture-friendly camp comes from an increased zeal for missions and evangelism that sees the liturgy as presenting a religious barrier to the church, to the people of our culture, excuse me, who will not join the church if they cannot get beyond the strange rituals of a traditional liturgical church. In a sense, the church is seen as mediating between two distinct conflicting cultures or worldviews, the biblical worldview and the culture of the United States. The missionary's task is to communicate the gospel. This begins with a clear proclamation of law to uncover unbelief, continues with a clear proclamation of the objective facts of the gospel of Christ's atonement through suffering, death, and vindication through resurrection, and concludes with an application of the gospel through the forgiveness of sins in baptism, word, and sacrament. The goal of proclamation is faith to believe all that the prophets have spoken about the Christ who has died and risen so that the world might know it has been redeemed and restored. The task of proclamation to this world is best served by speaking the language of the culture and using a style that culture understands. Culture needs to hear the message decoded in its own language and act on the basis of it. In this line, the culture-friendly camp then calls for user-friendly liturgies. It is said that these liturgies need to reflect the culture to attract the people of the culture. But how does one know what culture to imitate, what language to speak, what context to address? Here, the culture-friendly camp encourages liturgists to adopt those things close at hand that represent our common cultural experience. Today's media has created the possibility of a pan-American culture where, through radio, television, and print, a commonality exists between the diverse subcultures in American society. This pan-American culture has now become worldwide, and American Protestantism is seen in terms of neo-evangelicalism. Evangelical Christians are most representative of this group, since they are best known within our American Protestant culture for making peace with the language patterns and musical styles of the secular pop culture. By using secular forms and styles, the culture-friendly camp creates a receptive context for new converts who are easily assimilated into the church by means of user-friendly liturgies. These liturgies consciously appeal to the popular culture in their musical expressions, the language of the texts, and the loose informality of their liturgical styles. For a 20th century American, no jarring change in environment or ambiance should take place when one enters Christian liturgy. The America of the Protestant religious culture is the Christianity of a church that is culture friendly. Let me now discuss the culture critical camp. Needless to say, as Nathan Michoud poignantly points out, there is another alternative, which he describes as culture critical. Like the culture friendly camp, he says that the culture critical camp is also driven by evangelism, but differs in the composition of its adherents, who are primarily liturgiologists and biblical theologians. Since the beginning of the liturgical movement in the 19th century at the Benedictine Abbey of Solemnis, and particularly since Vatican II, liturgical research has exploded, particularly in the history, structure, and theology of worship. The culture critical camp studies the liturgy by using the insights of anthropologists, sociologists, and theologians. Historically, these studies show that liturgy transforms culture by taking on the culture and confronting it with the gospel. Evangelism and missions are central to the cultural critical camp because liturgy is the primary way of evangelizing the world. Liturgical scholars also make use of social sciences in their pursuit of a liturgy that is both current and traditional at the same time. My students know that I oftentimes, in teaching liturgy, spend a great deal of time talking about the anthropology of ritual behavior. As Mitchell notes, continuity is the final goal of the culture critical camp, so that the liturgy forms the church into a unified community, the body of Christ in the world to transform the world. Historical continuity is more valuable than contemporary conformity. Now, for the sake of time, I'm going to turn to the final section, in which I'm going to talk about moving towards a liturgical style that is distinctly Lutheran. Our contextualization as a Lutheran church, with its own liturgical tradition and its unique cultural and historical context, will be different from those around us. Some imitation will take place, but at the end of the day, we are not Roman Catholics or Anglicans or Southern Baptists or Pentecostals. We are Lutherans, for better or for worse. Is there an alternative between the culture-friendly and the culture-critical camps that will allow us to be faithful to our liturgical tradition while at the same time contemporary in our expressions? I believe that there is. Lutherans have a liturgical tradition that mediates between the two extremes and still maintains a liturgical ethos that is incarnational and sacramental. Luther restored the historic liturgy in a relatively simple setting, especially when it is compared to other liturgical traditions. Lutheran liturgy is